Welcome to the Fansmanship.com podcast, coming to you from San Luis Obispo, California.
Where you stand?
LA living grid locked in the fast lane. Trying to strike a rich match, play my cash game.
Welcome to the Fansmanship.com podcast, here today with a very special guest. She has been a baseball writer at ESPN Magazine for 8 years and is the author of a book I finished this past weekend, The Best Team Money Can Buy. It is Molly Knight. How's it going, Molly?
It's going great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely my pleasure. I read that you've been a Dodger fan your whole life. So what's your first memory as a fan at Dodger Stadium?
Wow, that's a great question. Unfortunately, I was too young to remember when the 88, the last time they won in 88.
Okay.
I think I really first started, I remember going to games in like 92, 93. Unfortunately, I didn't know that the 92 team was like a terrible 100-loss team until I recently I realized that, which is funny because I think I didn't care. I was just a kid and would cheer and count the beach balls and like I loved Brett Butler because he was small and fast.
Was that like Eric Davis? Was that like the Eric Davis team? What was
Eric Davis. I loved Mike Piazza, obviously, when he came in. That was really thrilling. It was totally weird. The players who, like when I was like 10, 11, 12, who came in, who I loved. And then it was really weird. The beginning of my career, some of those guys were like still around. So it's weird to be around, you know, like a Mike Piazza or Ken Griffey, like those types.
Sure.
I think we always sat in the top deck, and I always kept score, and I would keep count of the number of beach balls that were, and how many times a wave would go around the stadium. I was very into numbers even then.
That's fantastic. We have to drive about 3.5 hours down to the stadium from up here in San Luis Obispo, so we got to go to, you know, a couple, maybe three games a year, and it was always a down and back thing, and usually on a Sunday or something like that.
Yeah.
How did you come to be a Dodger fan? What do you have family who was big Dodger fans?
I was born into it. My family has been in Los Angeles for, on my mom's side, since the 1800s. So,
wow.
And then I had family from New York who were Brooklyn Dodger fans as well. So it's just sort of on all sides. There's never been any other team, from either my mom's side or my dad's side. They've always, my mom's dad, my grandfather had season tickets all through when my mom grew up. And nice. So it was a family thing.
So you talked about growing up and going to games and then covering some of those same guys early in your career. How does being a writer or a journalist kind of change your relationship with the game? It's something I'm always interested in when I talk to people who cover the game on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I grew up a Laker fan too, and I was a huge fan of like Magic Johnson and James Worthy and Byron Scott and all those guys.
Oh yeah,
I was pretty young during that era, but I loved like Dick Van Exel, Eddie Jones. You know, even though they weren't as good, I was really
Sadale Threet.
But what?
Sadale Threet.
Oh yeah, Sadale Threet, of course. And then when I was I sort of lost interest in the Lakers as the years went on, and I've had to ask myself, this makes no sense. They've won so many championships. You would think, you know, that I would be a huge Laker person and not as in like whatever about the Dodgers, because they haven't been there for World Series since 88. But I think it was because my family really, Laker games were always pretty expensive to go to, my dad just couldn't afford it. And so we could afford Dodger games in the top deck, so we would go. So I would go to like, you know, five or six Dodger games a year. And I think just being in that stadium and having some of my happiest memories is why my fandom was cemented. And I think I'm happy to say that I've not lost that. I still walk in that stadium, and just it's like I would imagine for some people, like what walking into a church is like. It's just like a really calming, wonderful, majestic place. And that hasn't been beaten out of me. You know, a lot of people I know cover baseball are really jaded and bitter and and don't even really like it that much. And that's not me. I love it. It's been hard at certain times. I wouldn't say it's hard to remain objective. I think that I think that being a fan actually in a way makes you more critical of the team. You know, I was hammering away when during the Frank McCourt ownership. but I think that's not been as hard as you know, covering players that you develop personal affection for, or subjects that you cover personal affection for, which I think happens in every field. I think every writer, there's going to be a player or two on each team who you realize, like, whoa, this is actually a really decent human being who is a good person and treats people well. And it sucks when you have to write about them in a slump, you know,
right,
or how maybe they shouldn't be playing. And you're like, oh, like, that's more of a human thing than like a team bias thing, if that makes sense.
It makes a ton of sense. And I really appreciate the insight. So you called it. I was following Twitter during the game two the other night. And you said, is this going to be the Chase Utley game? And
I don't know why I said that too. It's so funny. I don't think I've ever tweeted that before about any game and any person. I don't think I've ever asked if this is going to be the, it's not like it before every game. I'm like, is this going to be the Matt Harvey game? Is this going to be,
right,
you know, it's just,
right.
I just had a feeling. He came up, I guess part of it was Syndergaard had been awesome, and then he'd been tiring. Clearly, he'd thrown over 100 pitches, and they finally looked like they were starting to get to him. And here comes Chase Utley, and I'm thinking, oh man, this is exactly the kind of annoying like Chase Utley thing to do. You know, like it happened to the Dodgers a bunch of times. It's happened to every team. He just is super, super annoying, and we'll figure out a way to terrorize the other team. And I didn't know he was going to, like, you know, tackle somebody and it's going to be a huge, break someone's leg and it's going to be a huge issue. I thought maybe he was going to hit a home run or a double or whatever. I didn't see that, but he has certain players have a way of, like, I don't know, inflicting themselves onto the course of a game. And I think everybody saw that with the way that he just was like, I'm not letting that guy turn a double play, and you know what happened. I don't think he intended to. To be honest, I mean, I blame him for all of it, but at least I'm not exonerating him. But I don't think that went down the way he thought it was going to go, because I don't see how anybody can get hit in the head in the face that hard if they were expecting it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Generally speaking, if you think your head's about to get completely pummeled, you know, you draw back, you have your hands up, or you win. I think that the turn surprised him.
Right.
But again, he put himself in that situation.
That's right. Yeah. Right. He put himself in that position. Yeah. And the hit in the first place was such a bleeder. I mean, it was such a little line drive that has to be, you know, the slide, I mean, notwithstanding. Like you said, he always seems to do something kind of annoying.
It was a bad toss by Daniel Murphy. Again, I don't blame Murphy. I blame Utley. It was a bad toss to Tejada.
Sure.
It made him stretch and keep his back to Utley and left him vulnerable. Sort of like, you know, a quarterback throwing the ball to a defenseless receiver right in the, you know, crosshairs of, like, Junior Seau or Warren Sapp or somebody.
Right.
It kills me, because I don't think he would have turned that double play anyway.
No,
if Utley had just split into the base, they would have reviewed the play and they would have seen that Tejada never touched the base, and it would just be LOL Mets, you know?
Right.
Like, it wouldn't be, oh my God, Chase Utley is the biggest villain in the history of baseball, and all the Dodger fans, you know, are awful and horrible people. And,
right.
You know, it's just this gross narrative that took over.
So is the suspension warranted?
Well, first of all, I hate the idea that now somehow the Dodgers are supposed to, fans are supposed to feel like shamed or conflicted or whatever.
Thank you
for this. We're talking about people who have, and I've said this article in my book, that there are, I felt, and I know for certain because I covered the team and I was there, that you know, I could name half my family wanted that team to win more than some of the guys in that locker room. So they're mercenaries, and there's no greater example than that this year than of a guy like Chase Utley, who literally gets brought in for like 30 games, makes minimal impact. He's hitting like 200, whatever.
Yeah.
It'll be gone next year.
Yep.
And now it's like he's supposed to represent the Dodger empire or something. Like he's supposed to stand for like, you know, 50 years of someone's fandom.
Yeah.
And even today, it was crazy. I was seeing tweets about, oh, because the lineup was released. It's like, oh, you know, Mattingly's not sitting Utley today. It's like,
of course he's sitting Utley.
He's not the starting second baseman. Howie Kendrick is the man who's played second base in both in the previous two games.
And if Howie Kendrick doesn't start, then Kike should be a starter over Utley.
Yes.
I mean, come on.
Yes. No, it's uninformed, like, trying to drive another narrative of, like, right. I don't even know what. Because they would have been up in arms if he was starting.
Yep. Yep.
They would have been like, this is just confrontational, and because Utley wasn't even starting the first two games. You know, there's, right. It's just like, I think I personally would have considered, I can't believe Rollins is starting. I don't like that at all. Batting second, I'm dumbfounded. Which, of course, means he's going to, like, hit a home run or something.
Right.
I would have thought about starting Utley and batting him and just saying screw it and batting him leadoff, because I don't think Matt Harvey can help himself. I think he's an emotional player. I think that he has had his manhood and toughness questioned. I think the media in New York has been hysterical in both of their coverage of him and in the coverage of this Utley incident.
Yep.
And I think all of that leads to him, you know, throwing Utley, which at the minimum gives the Dodgers a base runner, and the maximum gets, depending on what happens, where the ball goes, gets them rejected from the game.
Yeah, which is kind of like Mattingly almost trolling Harvey, trying to, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. For first
and
guy.
It's easily defensible because of Utley's career numbers against Harvey. I mean, if Rollins is starting because he has decent numbers career against Harvey, Utley's numbers are way better.
Interesting.
And I don't think, and with Rollins, I mean, I will agree that it's tougher to replace Kendrick in the lineup at this point, since he swung the bat pretty well in the first two games. Seager has looked a bit overmatched. I don't think it's a mental thing for him. I just think it's tough to face these guys who are throwing, 98 miles an hour. This isn't Oklahoma City anymore, kid,
Yeah, Syndergaard was ridiculous, yeah.
Ridiculous. Like, to the point where you see those guys and you wonder, how is the Mets even lose a game this year? Like, this is a joke. But then as soon as it's like, oh, the Dodger hitters need to wake up. Well, as soon as they replace those guys at bullpen, it's like, whoa, here come the runs,
Right.
Like, it's not, we want to blame our guys.
Right.
Sports fans want to blame their guys for not being good enough when sometimes it's just a question of the opponent is just better.
Yeah.
Or, like I thought the story on people talking about Kershaw that, like, well, DeGrom was amazing. They couldn't hit him.
Yeah.
He was so good.
And Gonzalez said it, when he came off, when he got interviewed at the end of the game, guy's not throwing a 90 mile an hour changeup. So I'm feeling pretty good about, facing
right.
that pitcher. I know
right.
you're limited on time here. I just want to, I want to ask you a couple of future questions for the Dodgers.
Sure.
You covered a lot of Yasiel Puig in your book, and there are some amazing stories about Zach Greinke too. Guys whose, futures are a little more hazy, I think, even Puig's future right now, a little bit more hazy than it might have been even at the beginning of the year, especially. He's a guy who I think his story becomes more fascinating by the, or maybe there's more of a chance of him actually moving or doing something, given the fact that he was injured this year and given his history that he has. What's his future, you think?
Well, it's interesting. I think it's up to him. I think that this was the first year in his life that he didn't succeed in baseball, and a big part of that was injury. But he was also not very good, not very great out there. Not as good as we know that he is capable of, certainly. And he doesn't seem to take his fitness very seriously and his preparation and all that. And why would he? Because before he could just roll out of bed, show up, not know what's going on, and hit like 350. I mean, I wouldn't put in time either. Who cares? I'd stay home and play video games and whatever, right? Like, by something's easy, why would you make it harder than it needs to be? But I think this game is too hard for it to be. Once people figure out how to pitch to you and develop a plan, you've got to readjust. So I think for him, if he puts in the time and really commits himself, mind, body, and soul, that means including in the off season. Like, you know, he doesn't like to lose weight. He's going to have to start doing that. You know, he's going to have to start extra work, extra reps, extra film watching. Just figuring out an approach, and he can absolutely be an all-star. And he's still so young. It's not like we can say, oh, geez, you know, it's over. The Dodgers need to trade him. But he hasn't really been a problem in the clubhouse this year, but also he hasn't really been a factor because he hasn't really been playing.
Right.
So it's not as if like some crazy thing. I mean, frankly, Matt Harvey was more of a distraction to the Mets this year than Puig was to the Dodgers. And I think that they would be wise to trade him in the offseason, not because he's some kind of a jerk, but because, you know, he's a headache, and they don't necessarily need him. They could get some young hitting they could control.
Right.
That'd be a great thing for them, I think, because they've already got, you know, three kids and some regard to Grom and Maps, and I don't know, maybe it's just not worth the headache that it brings. But yeah, I with Granke, so it's clear that I don't think the front office is really is ready to give up on him, and he's cheap.
Right.
I think that they'll keep him. I mean, of course, any player can get traded at any time.
Sure.
But it seems like this front office is still, still a bit starry-eyed for him and his potential in the production his youth. But with Cranky, it's just, I think he would be, it depends. If the Dodgers offer him, make him a huge competitive offer, I think it would be a mistake for him to leave. Personally, I think as somebody who has dealt with anxiety before, not the kind he has dealt with, which I think is even makes it even more key because of his social anxiety. You know, every year at the trade deadline, when the Dodgers get new players every year, it's stressful for him because he's just like, oh, new people. He doesn't like, you know, oh, there are new people on the team playing, or new people every day, and he, over time, he gets used to it. But I think that's a whole thing that's like, you don't take into consideration is that his comfort level. Clearly, he's comfortable. He's growing his hair out. He's walking up to Careless Whisper.
He's calling guys out for their hygiene.
Yeah, he loves Rick Honeycutt. He loves throwing to Grandal. I call him the perfect catcher. You know, and you know Grandal's going to be there for a while as long as he's healthy, which, you know, hopefully he will be next year.
Yeah,
he's very close with Kershaw, you know, AJ Ellis, all these guys. And I just think, you know, if he just had a kid, they have a house in Studio City. I think he should stay just so that he's, for his mental, you know, for that. I don't think that could be understated from somebody who had to walk away from the game because he was so uncomfortable with his surroundings. I think that comfort is a huge thing. But we'll see. I mean, I'm worried he'll end up in San Francisco.
That's the one that I was going to say. The Giants, for whatever reason, the negative voice inside my head says that the Dodgers are going to go after David Price and the Giants are going to scoop up Zach Greinke. And it just makes me anxious and sad. And the fact that it's next year's a even year again, and it's still on the West Coast. It's all the things that Dodger fans dread. And gosh, I know it's only been, you know, 25, 30 years since we won a championship, but you know, in LA, but you know, maybe that's like the mindset I'm starting to have as a fan. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's hard, and I mean, God help us all if he winds up being a Giants fan, because I mean, I'm always going to root for him, always, and so
right, exactly.
I'm going to take so much abuse for it, and I don't care. And I get that point in my career anyway. Like, I don't know if my Dodger fandom is intact because I met a lot of these guys. I mean, I met all of them, and I grew to really like and care about some of them. And I don't know if, you know, that will, my fandom will start to wane once those guys get older, get traded, get retired, whatever, you know. We'll see. But yeah, I mean, there are guys on other teams who I'm just like, go on your eBay, you know. I could never root against that guy.
Sure.
Dick Schumacher. Nick Punto. I mean, they're guys who are just Dan Heron, D. Gordon, you know, like these are people who are just like really decent humans.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's going to be hard for me. Now, if they lose Granke to the Giants, signing David Price would be a nice consolation. And I hope that happens. They have to. I can't see them not, you know, letting Granke go and replacing him with like a Mike a week type. Like that's not going to happen.
Right. Yeah. So, God. Yeah. Like you said, help us if he goes to the Giants, because then I'm gonna have to like a guy on the Giants, and I don't mind some of the guys, but can you imagine him and Bumgarner on the same pitching rotation? I mean,
no, it'd be a comedy.
It'd be a comedy up there.
I don't know why everybody. I mean, look, I grew up a Dodger fan. I get it. Like that, everyone hates the Giants here, but I look at that team. I mean, geez, they all seem to like each other. There's no drama. They don't like bring players in who are clubhouse cancers, who are awful human beings.
Right.
Bruce Bochy is fantastic. He's calm and he's a smart manager. Buster Posey is a dream. You know, it's like it blows my mind every year when I hear that the Giants, some free agent didn't want to go play there. Like they always come in second to somebody, and I don't know if they're offering way less money or what the deal is. Because they win too. But yeah. I don't know why you wouldn't want to go be a part of that and have like a 50-50 chance of winning a World Series rank that year. Yeah. You know, like I don't know.
It's
cold there. I like to wear sundresses, but I don't think any Major League Baseball players have that problem. So.
Here in San Luis Obispo, it's the Dodger Giant DMZ, really. You know, the northern border of San Luis Obispo is the media market border. And if you get north in San Luis Obispo County, there's more Giants fans. Southern San Luis Obispo County, there's more Dodger fans. It's really like an interesting place.
That's like the Bristol, Connecticut. You know, ESPN is in Bristol. And it's exactly the halfway point between New York and Boston.
There you go. Yeah.
And so it's very, like, all the bars have to have Red Sox little light-up beer signs and Yankees light-up beer signs.
Yeah, you go to Target and there's, Dodgers gear and Giants gear, both. I know you got to run. Really quick, Kershaw game four, the right move?
Yes. You got to have him out there. I think after going to game one, I have a new theory about all this, his so-called struggles. I don't think it's, I think he does pitch differently in the playoffs. I don't think it's a mental, it's a choke thing. I think it's just, he's exerting so much effort. He wants it so bad and he's just like pushing so hard that he runs out of gas physically. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's like, you know, or like a panic attack or whatever, or lack of toughness or something. I just think he thinks, okay, well, it's all up to me because our bullpen once again is not any good, and I've got to try to throw a complete game shutout right now. And here I go. And rather than just focusing on putting on heroes each inning, which is what you got to do in the playoffs, just okay, here I go. I think that if he knew he could trust the bullpen, I think he would wind up lasting longer.
Or if his guys got him a few runs, how about? It's mind-boggling how the Dodgers hitters just go in the tank, all the time when he pitches in the playoffs.
Yeah. I mean, part of that is because they're facing the other team's ace, too. But yeah, no, it is. And it's been that way for a long time. And, you know, if Baez gets that out, Kershaw's line for that game is 6 2/3, one run, 11 strikeouts, nobody's saying that he pitched bad. It was just,
if the Dodgers put up four or five runs. Yeah. You know,
right.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And so, I mean, if shoulda, woulda, coulda, I think the mentality tomorrow, needs to be, look, you're a horse. You're amazing. You've gotten us here. We're going to try to help you out for once, we're going to, do our best to score some flipping runs, and you pitch six innings and keep us in this game, get zero runs or one run or whatever, and if we can't get nine outs from our bullpen, we don't deserve to live anyway, it's ridiculous to expect someone, because tomorrow's like, he's pitching on 3 days rest. Nobody throws a complete game shut up on 3 days rest. It doesn't happen. You don't leave the person out there. It's like human abuse.
Right. Right. You got to score runs.
Yeah. You got to score runs. If you can go six and give up none, fantastic, Right. I mean, but for him, that's not going to be good enough. We hold him to a different standard. He holds himself to a different standard. So hopefully they'll score some runs for him.
I sometimes wonder if Kershaw is too good a guy, almost. I don't know. I feel like You know, not as good a guy might not care so much, and so might not expend so much energy. I don't know. It's kind of a weird.
I mean, like
Kobe Bryant. I always talk about. You know, he seems like kind of a jerk on the court. I think Kenny Smith's called him a basketball butthole before. Like that's the kind of guy like who goes out and does that. I mean, like Madison Bumgarner last year.
Right.
I don't know. Is Kershaw too good a guy? I don't know.
Yeah, possibly, but I also think, you know, 2013, he did a lot better. Well, for the last game, which he was just bad.
Right.
You know, they had a better bullpen.
Right.
So I don't think that it was like, well, you know, shoot, Kersh, you're gonna have to do everything tonight.
Right.
You know, I think there was more of like a team approach, and I just think it's really hard. I mean, even with the Giants had a fantastic bullpen last year. So Bumgarner didn't need, it wasn't like, oh, you're our only option. Yes, he was the only good starter, but they had, you know, Romo and Casilla and I mean, all of them were good, you know? And who's that guy, not Perret, the Lefty, whatever his name is. I forget his name right now. Excuse me. But their team was really, I mean, they had a great bullpen. So, like, I just think that every year it's so frustrating because the teams are left standing in the World Series in the end. Are the teams with the best bullpen, and that's the one thing that like seems impossible to control. So I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Anything could happen, and we're excited for it. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I just I think the Mets have the advantage tonight with Harvey going over Anderson. But this series has already been like quite crazy. I don't know if a brawl is going to break out. I don't know if Harvey's going to do something stupid because he can't help himself. I don't know. So anything can happen, I guess, tonight.
That's why you have to watch this game. And I'm going to say you have to read Molly Knight's book. It is called The Best Team Money Can Buy. Are you still signing copies for people and mailing them to them, or are you all out?
They can email me at bestteambooks@gmail.com if they want to. If they want to order a personalized copy, it's only the cost of postage really, you know, the difference from Amazon or whatever.
They can do that. I bought three of them. I bought one for each of my grandmothers. And they make great gifts, and I had to give them to them before their birthday and before Christmas because guess what? It's the pennant race. So
It's the pennant race. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'll come back anytime.
Yeah, thanks so much, Molly. I really appreciate it, and have fun watching the game tonight. We'll be following you on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle? @ Molly Knight?
Molly_Knight.
Molly_Knight. Thanks again.
Okay,
take care.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Fansmanship Podcast. For more podcasts and more in-depth sports discussion, go to fansmanship.com.
Stuck on down in Trouble Town. It's a lonely place, it's true. Street lights so bright they blind my vision, and the people on the streets they beat me up till I'm black and blue.